broadcasting from the Unshackled Studios in Melbourne. This is Wilmsfront, brought to you by theunshackled.net. Now here's Tim Wilms.
Hello everyone and welcome to tonight's show. The date is Wednesday the 8th of April 2020. It is 7 p.m. here in Melbourne. We are live on the now titled Wilmsfront YouTube channel, and also finally back on Entropy, the YouTube enhanced software. I will just put it in the live chat here as well. Of course, if you're not familiar with Entropy, but most of our live chatters who watch our Unshackled Productions are, you can click on the link, or you can directly ask me a question during the show, and you can also support the production of not just Wilmsfront, but all of our Unshackled Productions through sending a super chat. So the Australian government and the new national cabinet, they made the decision very early on when the coronavirus pandemic, it was clear it had arrived here, that saving lives was their paramount goal, with the means to achieving that goal being to flatten the curve of daily infections, which we are achieving at the moment. The curve has not just flattened, it is now dipping, which is very good news. However, to achieve this flattening of the curve and to make sure the death toll didn't substantially rapidly increase like it has in the United States today, this meant shutting down all non-essential businesses and issuing a state home order. So that's being enforced at the state level. We cannot leave our homes unless we are traveling for essential supplies, medical care, exercise, work, or for education. This has seen hundreds of thousands of Australians and millions around the Western world lose their jobs and have their businesses destroyed. Governments are ramping up the debt, and the money printing presses are going overtime to pay for the new welfare needed to compensate those who've lost their jobs and businesses during the pandemic. The angst, stress, and uncertainty, plus the indignity of having your livelihood cut off and being confined to your home, it's going to have a severe impact on the mental health of millions of Australians. So how can this be managed? Is the disease worse? Is the cure worse than the disease, is what a lot of people have been asking. Tonight, I'll be playing my recent recorded interview with Dr. Tanvir Ahmed, who is a psychiatrist based in inner West Sydney. He has been a commentator in the Australian media on both mental health and politics for over a decade. He has previously written for the Australian newspaper. You can now read his current columns in the Australian Financial Review. He is the author of two books, The Exotic Rissole, published in 2011, and Fragile Nation in 2017. I interviewed Tanvir about his Fragile Nation book, which was published by Connor Publishing at the Melbourne launch. It was one of the early Unshackled Waves episode. He's also appeared countless times on television and radio. Currently, he's a regular panelist on the Sky News Opinion program In My View, which airs at 8 p.m. Sydney time every Sunday night. So without further ado, let's get into tonight's featured interview. And to just set the record straight, now, this interview is not live. It was recorded last Friday. So I'll come back after I've played this recorded interview to give a wrap-up of the rest of today's coronavirus-related news, and also the fallout from the High Court quashing Cardinal George Pell's child sex conviction. All right, let's get into it.
This is Wilmsfront, brought to you by theunshackled.net.
Tanvir, good to see you again.
Pleasure to be with you, Tim. Thanks for having me.
I know that we previously saw each other in person, but in this age of social isolation, when you say to someone, good to see you, you can only see them through a camera in the virtual world.
Yeah, it's nice to see you digitally. You know, it's, we're all getting more used to that, and we'll probably get more and more skilled at that, I think.
Obviously, my audience is familiar that I'm broadcasting from my new home studio. And obviously, with your work as a psychiatrist, it's normally done face-to-face in a consulting room. You've also traveled around the cities and the regions to meet different clientele. So how's your own work changed with the containment measures and social distancing and isolation measures?
Look, unlike most of other medicine, I mean, I guess psychiatrists in some ways have one advantage that we don't actually need to do physical procedures by and large. So digital, more than most aspects of medicine, digital should work better. And in many ways, the government's been trying to get us to do more digital work, especially regionally. I mean, one of the most difficult things about servicing Australia is, you know, we're so spread out and so not densely populated. For a range of reasons, makes servicing in a whole range of areas quite difficult. So the government's wanted us to go more digital for years and had various incentives to do so. So on that front, coronavirus has escalated that. You know, probably what's taken more than a decade for government, coronavirus has done it in about 2-3 weeks. So suddenly people are shifting quite dramatically to Skype, FaceTime, you know, webcam, whatever it is. I think it is more a little bit more challenging, but you know, I think it's good enough. You don't get the subtleties necessarily. I think you can still form strong human connections, you know, digitally. And I think you probably get more skilled at doing it. But look, overall, I guess in some ways my practice has suffered much less than many of my colleagues. So, for example, a lot of surgeons and other doctors, they've had elective procedures shut down. So like a lot of other sections of the economy, even many doctors, so you would think healthcare is a major victor of the current circumstances from a industry or economic point of view. That's not necessarily the case. There are differences between, say, the private and public sector in particular, but psychiatry certainly hasn't suffered, but we've had to go more digitally. And I've certainly had a few colleagues that have probably more frightened. Not that I'm frightened, I'm probably more cautious than especially frightened, but I've certainly had colleagues who are really, you know, almost immediately, probably 2 weeks ago, well, you know, took their files home and said, like, I'm not seeing a single person face-to-face. So the reality is doctors are at greater risk, you know, right across the world, something like 3 to 4 times higher risk, healthcare workers. You know, many doctors have died in Italy and Spain in particular, as well as in the UK and to some extent now. So that risk is there, but fortunately for psychiatrists, probably slightly less.
Yeah, we've seen here in Australia healthcare workers that I think it's the Prince Alfred in Melbourne contract coronavirus, and over in the UK there's been NHS workers who've contracted it. So that is a challenge in itself, because hospitals can be incubators themselves. But you raised 2 points there about the containment measures, that there is room for innovation, and thankfully our national broadband network has held up for the moment. There doesn't seem to be as much web frustration as many of us feared, but there's also that disruption as well. And obviously a lot of, including health professionals, are being redistributed, and we've sort of seen that in more of the general economy, where, for example, Qantas and Village Roadshow are trying to get their workforce redistributed to Woolworths, which is good, but it's the disruption there. And there's also a lot of industries where it's, if you're running a business, then it's a completely different, you can't really redistribute your business in a short space of time. And obviously the purpose of these coronavirus containment measures, or lockdown as we're sort of starting to call it now, is to save lives and stop our health system and workers being overwhelmed. But with this massive disruption, some are able to be redistributed, some can't be. Many have considered, is the cure worse than the disease, because business and economic shutdowns in the past have proven to cause mental health issues and family and relationship breakdowns. And being confined to your home, not having a means to dignified work. Where do you stand on this?
I'm not sure I've come to a clear decision as yet. In some ways, perhaps I've become a bit more compliant over the years. I mean, I in general, I'm trusting the government, who have the kind of exceptional data on this in terms of trying to balance the public health requirements with the economic ones. I mean, so over the years, I've been a critic of some public health philosophy where, you know, in many respects, there's an overreach. You know, for example, say in Sydney where you had the big lockdown, you know, there's often these calls to ban this or that, you know, ban sugar, etc. So in some ways, a lot of public health ideas in recent decades have overlapped with a lot of luxury ideas we've had more generally, with sort of great prosperity. And potentially now what we're seeing, what, you know, what public health is really about. I mean, this is why public health came about. The history of medicine is primarily the history of infection. And it's only probably in the last half a century where it's been something other than that. So we forget the central place of infectious disease and its control through not just the history of medicine, but the history of civilization. So what we're seeing now has been with us for a long time. We've just forgotten about it, given our prosperity and our mastery in some respects of our environment and the world around us. In terms of the economic shock, I mean, it's enormous, isn't it? I mean, I guess arguably the way I interpret it is this: we essentially live in such a prosperous society that we can essentially value human life to such an extent that we can, and I'm all for this by and large, that we can effectively decide that we're going to save 100,000 people at the risk, at a significant cost economically. Now, you are right, in the longer term, which is much tougher to predict, that will also have its costs, you know, be it in potentially mental health costs, potentially suicide, potentially other health problems. That is a possibility. And I mean, the hope is that we can get on top of this sooner rather than later. But in the short term, I think there was a genuine risk. So I think public health and doctors more generally often calculate the immediate catastrophic health risk at the expense of all else. And we see this in a whole range of policy areas. And I think in general, doctors are not so well equipped to see other trade-offs, the social and economic trade-offs versus the health ones. But I think in this case, when you see some of the worst modelling, and realistically, I don't think any Western society can tolerate, you know, hundreds of thousands of deaths. And really, that was what the modelling was showing. I think it'll become much clearer, possibly in upcoming weeks, actually, sooner rather than later. In the next few weeks, we'll get a much clearer sense, as we're getting more and more testing, we'll get a much clearer sense of what actually is the prevalence of coronavirus in the community, and what is the actual mortality. Is it, you know, 0.5%? Is it closer to 2%? And if it's closer to 0.5%, then I think there will be grounds to relax some of these measures. So really, a lot of this is what might look like overreach, I think, is in part a reaction to not having all the data and the risk that you would have a catastrophic and a very quick one. If you had a bit of time with this, sure, you could potentially, you had some leeway, but, you know, and the reality is we can all see what's happened in places like Italy and Spain, and that's really not something any government's going to take. They're going to err on the side of overreach, you know, to avoid that kind of catastrophe, I think. Saying that, look, in the short term, I am actually agreeable to the government reactions. I think some of it is a bit over the top and not entirely based on evidence, you know, only two people walking around, or, you know, you can't sit in a park, or I think some of it, I'm not sure there's any basis for it. And it just sounds a bit totalitarian and a bit over the top, especially in a place where, you know, we're not Italy and Spain. We've had less than 25 deaths. Yes, we have to protect the future and not getting worse, but I think some of it is not terribly justifiable. And I'm not sure how we, not that it's happened, but I can't see how we could justify, say, a further lockdown, for example.
You're right that we've seen a lot of compliance with the shutdown measures and the business closures, but there has, I share your concerns this week that there does seem to be more of a draconian step, especially with the police in your home state of New South Wales driving onto the parks, and that people who are practicing social distancing, they're reading by themselves or just sunbaking, getting a bit of vitamin D, because that is also healthy as well. And obviously the police, they want to look like they're enforcing the these containment measures. And obviously when you say trust the government, obviously I don't like that as a general rule, but we have seen with the sort of concern expressed this week that our government, through its national cabinet, is they've said they're going to try and get the balance right, and they basically implemented these measures at the exact right time because they didn't want to go with the hard lockdown, but they don't want to end up like Spain or Italy. And New York, it looks like it'll go down the Spain-Italy path. It's on a terrible trajectory.
I think that's true. I mean, I guess that's these are places that are trying to catch up. So that's where I think we are slightly ahead of the curve, because we implemented fairly strong measures beforehand. We places like Italy and Spain, you know, they're having huge soccer games, parties, you know, the flights from China were coming consistently. So they're playing catch up. And I think that's why they've had to have an extra overreach. Whereas, you know, a significant proportion of our cases have come from overseas, you know, not least cruise ships. So that's where some of our failures have happened. I mean, look, on something such as sort of world historical as this sort of thing, you know, the reality is none of us know, because we don't actually have all the information.
Yeah, exactly.
So there is the prospect we are overreaching. However, if we are overreaching and we can, that's a temporary one, then I think, you know, a country like Australia can get back on its footing pretty fast. But if the problem is, if we didn't, you know, the alternative is really quite, you know, really quite frightening. You know, potentially having, you know, Australia's never seen anything like that. We imagine having, you know, tens of thousands. And we do have our advantages, you know, the lower density of our population, for example, you know, that's one. So I think there's just our relative isolation and the fact we can pretty much, you know, bring down the hatches. So I think we may well have some unique advantages that may allow us to reduce the restrictions. That's my hope anyway. So as we learn more, we'll get a better sense of, okay, what are the advantages we have and how can we parlay that? And obviously some countries like Sweden, for example, are, you know, taking quite different measures. And again, it'll become clearer in the coming weeks how successful that is. And the reality is, if they have been quite successful, you know, that'll be quite a model, I think, where, you know, to a large extent, you can let things go on. I mean, the real thing is, if you can immediately test people positive, quarantine them, you know who they are, if you have that capacity, then you've got much more control over this. And I think that testing capacity is starting to come up, and you're getting new technologies too. So there's enormous energy being devoted to this. So as soon as you can get a quick result, and you know very quickly as an administration where the people infected are, where they need to be quarantined, how you limit their contacts, then you've got a much stronger, once you can see the enemy, you've got a much better chance then of, you know, allowing everything in and around the enemy to function. At this stage, we're not quite on top of that central concept, though, being able to see the enemy. And that's why we're having to really batten down the hatches.
Yeah, because it's a virus, not a human being. Even the medical professionals, the virologists, they still don't know everything about it, and that's why a lot of the any sort of predictions, including media commentators such as myself, make it's almost folly at the moment. But you're right that Australia, our tyranny of distance, as historian Geoffrey Blainey said, is our greatest strength here, and we are getting ahead with the testing, rolling out the testing, which is one of the best ways where we can identify who has the virus and better quarantine rather than have a mass lockdown. But it was 2 weeks ago when the National Cabinet made their decision to close cafes, bars, restaurants, pubs, where people congregate in large numbers, and there was evidence on that previous weekend they weren't practicing social distancing. And so on the Monday morning, we saw those large lines outside of Centrelink offices, the federal government's welfare headquarters, and obviously the sudden and unexpected shock of being in that line, not due to your own mistakes, because the government has shut down your industry. It's not that you got stood down because you did a bad job or because your business model was bad, but just because these measures are necessary during the pandemic. And there's also being in that jobless queue, there's the removal of dignity. And I know that there is this sort of expression where, oh, the government's got this grant or handout, I should see if I can apply to get it. But there's a lot of people who don't want to put their hand out to government for a payment. They want to be self-sufficient. So there is that stripping of your independence.
Oh, of course. I mean, that's one of the most horrific things about this. You know, it's people who had, probably, have never got close to a Centrelink office and suddenly having to line up. And I think that's one of the areas the government could have done better, actually, because there's no reason. I think other parts of the world where they were able to get money straight into people's bank accounts, and really the government has the ability to potentially do that. So some of those things where you've got all these people waiting hours in front of a Centrelink, I think there's a real blow to human dignity that was unnecessary. You know, there's enough distress as it is. So trying to minimize that at every corner, should be considered. Now, look, it's horrible. I'm seeing people like that. You're not only, you've got people whose retirement savings have been slashed. You've got people overnight lost their businesses and their jobs. I mean, it's horrible. I mean, in our lifetimes, we haven't seen anything like this. I mean, I'm lucky, it really doesn't, certainly it doesn't affect my income or work. So in that respect, I'm extremely lucky, one of the lucky few. And it's horrible to see this around us happen. And I hope, we get out of it faster. I think Australia is better placed. And you are right. This is one of the places we often complain about, being isolated or being a kind of a cultural backwater, all these things. I mean, this is one area, this is one time when, I think it's our isolation and our distance, both Australia and New Zealand, we can really shut the gates. And I hope that will be a big advantage in what's happening. I mean, from the economic side, again, it's so early in this, there'll be all manner of people with all manner of stuff to say. And you are right, there is the prospect that the cure, may be, pretty brutal, with significant side effects. And it is hard. I mean, the reality is the measure, and some people have written about this, and it's always a tough one to argue. The unit of measure that you're trying to save is, some economists have argued this, public health officials too, is life years adjusted. So which measures, not single lives, but life years. And the reality is it brings up things about, are old people's lives, worth less than young people's lives? Because taking a lot of jobs, and you can actually calculate and give estimates that, say someone in their 30s and 40s with bad job and their risk of having various diseases thereafter, not, being unemployed, that may well reduce life years in the very longer term. I mean, we can't predict it with certainty, but you can certainly, you can model some of these things. So that's a very challenging debate to have. And because really what we're doing at the moment, yeah, that's the, you know, that's the trade-off we're making all the time. Because whenever we ease restrictions, there's a prospect that that will lead to more lives lost. But whenever you increase them, there's also all this, if not what called mortality, so much morbidity, not even saying it properly. And that's the notion of illness and loss of function without actual death. So it's where you're ill, you can't do all these things, but you're not necessarily dead. So it's like we're choosing a lot of that over the actual death part, but the longer term impacts of that, you know, may well be equal or if not worse. And again, the reality is we just don't know. It's still quite early. We will know probably fairly soon. Within, you know, within weeks, we'll get a quick sense. But I mean, these are, you know, these are huge decisions that governments are making. And I think a lot of it is just that scare you get when you're seeing the absolute misery that's in Italy and Spain. I think when governments see that, they're like, we cannot even remotely risk that. I mean, you've got economies like the United States on, you know, on its knees almost. And, you know, that's the power of this virus. You know, it's really, it's smashing through any weaknesses we have in our systems. It's exposing them in a big way. And that's why I think overall Australia is, I think it's showing how good our systems are. I mean, the reality is we do have a very strong welfare system. We have an excellent universal healthcare system. We were already very wealthy beforehand, so we probably have a much stronger kind of safety net in terms of savings as well as the welfare. So in some ways, I think all our relative strength, and I think our institutional strength, it will also be shown here. I mean, the fact is we have some of the best doctors in the world, some of the best public health officials, and I think a lot of our policy makers too, I think, are, you know, what will be shown to be of excellent quality here. So I think compared to other parts of the world, I think our, in terms of when the, you know, when the marks are awarded, at least at this stage, I think we'll, you know, I think we'll come up very well.
There were a lot of Australians at the beginning when the containment measures were announced and implemented did fear that there was going to be some form of civil unrest or and quite a lot of rage. We haven't seen that. It's certainly what there has been a lot of shock because we've had 29 years of uninterrupted economic growth in Australia, and for we probably all thought that pandemics were something of the past, that we'd mastered medicine. But of course, viruses like humanity evolve as well, and so the main issue or to how to get through this is not there's not it, there doesn't seem like there's going to be a breakdown in public order now, but certainly people they need to be able to cope and adjust quickly because of this shock. We've just gone through the Centrelink lines, and also with the business shutdowns, we now have the social distancing isolation measures where governments are now telling Australians to stay at home, do not leave unless it's for work, getting essential supplies and exercise. You have your wife and children, so you're lucky that you've got each other to help support you, but not everyone is so fortunate. And it amazed me that 25% of private residents in Australia are single dwellings, which that shocked me that there's that much loneliness in Australia, and especially during this time.
Yeah, we certainly have high rates of single parent places. Now, look, loneliness isn't the same as living alone. There'll be a lot of people who live alone who would say they're not necessarily lonely. because they'll still be well connected, etc., but they prefer to live alone. But you are right. I mean, that's one of the hardest parts, even though I've got my immediate, say, wife and children. You know, like many others, you know, my parents, we're trying to kind of isolate them, and it's horrible, isn't it? Like, you'll have your kid's birthday and they can't see. We're trying to call them every day and stay in contact however we can. But, I mean, that's a huge challenge. So on one level, an interesting thing I've seen with some of my patients, on one level, obviously there's a great deal of emotional distress, but at the same time, for a lot of people, they've never had a sense of this sort of shared threat. So even though we're kind of, you know, all kind of stuck in our home, we probably never felt the same sense of shared threat. So a lot of people who do have psychological disorders, and they've usually, part of the problem has been they experience it alone. So on some level, some of them aren't quite as distressed as you might think, because they feel, I guess, more connected to the people around them, even though they may be physically distant. So that's an interesting thing. So some aspects of mental health will not necessarily worsen. Some will. And the aspects that will worsen will partly be due to very practical reasons. So in the Western world, you know, sometimes what we, you know, sort of negatively call affluenza or something, there's certainly an element of mental health that has been about this combination of great prosperity and a kind of lack of purpose, where, you know, people have had a kind of pointlessness to their lives, but they've been very wealthy, but they're trying to find a wider purpose or meaning. Whereas in some ways that's been pricked quite thoroughly by this, where people now have a much stronger sense of, I need to survive, I need to, you know, provide, et cetera. It's kind of back to basics, you know, economy, back to essentials. So you'll find in some people that actually, from a purely mental health point of view, it can actually improve some people, because it just gives them much firmer direction and need. And this has been seen in the world wars and that kind of thing. Not only do people feel a much stronger sense of shared purpose, it can also heighten certain social roles. So back then, when you had much more traditional households, for example, the women's role in the house was especially valued. They had to manage the house, etc. Obviously, for men, it can be harder, because many of them lose their provider role. So in some ways it can be more challenging on one respects. The caring role can be, I think there'll be a lot more men these days that will be engaged more thoroughly in the caring roles, be it with grandparents or children, you know, much more so. So it'll be, you know, there'll be a whole wealth of data that comes from this, you know, showing some of our social changes. But I think there'll be some things that'll revert some very traditional models as well. I think that'll be interesting to see. I mean, so far, look, I'm not seeing, you know, suddenly like a huge spike in, you know, say people getting suicidal or anything like that. I think at the moment people are very much like, right, we need to survive. There's a real strong sense of purpose and trying to band together. There's certainly an anxiety, but that anxiety is thoroughly realistic, whereas most of the people I'd previously seen with anxiety disorders, it was usually a overestimation of risk. You know, as people who, you know, couldn't go outside without getting panic attacks or something like that. Whereas now, the sense of threat is a perfectly legitimate one. You know, it's certainly not a pathological one.
You mentioned affluenza, which is, as you said, that it's people who are searching for meaning and tend to base their success in life by what material possessions or lifestyle they're living. And that's been completely stripped now. We did see in the early days with the panic buying quite a bit of selfish behavior in the supermarkets with those fights that were filmed about toilet paper in the supermarkets, and there was quite a lot of national cringe and embarrassment. And then there was that famous footage and photos of people out at Bondi Beach social distancing. And we have at the moment those who are returning to Australia forced into mandatory isolation in hotels doing those videos complaining about the conditions, because breakfast was late and apparently it wasn't cooked to their preferred taste. But we are seeing, on the whole, a transition from an individualistic, materialistic culture to one of community and national and civic duty. As you said, our basic survival instincts have kicked in, and we also need to be more of a community. And our leaders have said, and even though they are trying to police these, they are relying on people to do the right thing. And there is also a lot of social, as it's called, social pressure on people to practice proper social distancing and do the right thing by each other.
Yeah, look, absolutely. Look, I think Australians are pretty compliant people, to be honest. I mean, we're not as, I don't think we're terribly individualistic, actually. I think we're quite pragmatic. And realistically, I mean, we love regulations and all this stuff. I mean, we put up with all manner of stuff. So we are, I think, quite a compliant, authority-loving people, despite being, you know, probably amongst the most in, I think we're closer to, say, Britain in terms of following rules and all that kind of stuff than we are to the Americans as such. So we're a pragmatic people. We're not an ideological people, I don't think. So I think people are quite quick to shift to what's necessary. And even though we complain about, you know, hating our politicians, not trusting them, but I think, again, part of that, I still think of so much of what's happened in recent decades were luxuries. So many of our debates and, you know, our angst was really a function of how prosperous we were. And we could sort of get away with it. But I think when things, you know, when you batten down the hatches and things get real, as they very much have, I think our politicians, for the most part, you know, come to the party. And I think then partly we've got no choice to trust them to some extent, but I think we do trust them then. I think, you know, we don't think there's some other, there's obviously some very difficult trade-offs, but I think when it really matters, we trust our key authorities, you know, be it our government, our in this case, a lot of the doctors and the top scientists. We may be a bit more skeptical of the media, but I think overall, our institutions are much more solid than we've probably given them credit for.
It's interesting seeing somebody like Mike Carlton. I'm not sure if you've ever encountered him in person or online, but he's always been quite vitriolic on Twitter. But he's come to the realization that this is a warlike situation. And of course, he says, I don't like the Liberals, don't like Scott Morrison, but he's our war leader. We basically need to stop all this bickering, this Scotty from marketing stuff, to basically help see our nation through it. And of course, we've had, as you're alluding to, toxic politics for the last 10 years. We are still seeing a lot of sniping online, but sort of those petty political squabbles. I mean, who thought that Christian Porter and Sally McManus would become basically best buddies?
Some very interesting bedfellows in recent weeks, don't they? So, you know, they've come together. I mean, this is where, yeah, again, very practical, a lot of old ideologies. It would be interesting what happens, you know, on the other side of this. And, you know, I know some of the things, say, your site has railed against, and rightly so, you know, some of, be it from, you know, safe spaces on universities to veganism to the worst parts of, say, animal rights and some of the extinction rebellion. So some of the worst aspects of the left. And look, there's, you know, this happens on the right too, but to a different extent. You know, a lot of that has been pricked. They've been shown for the non-problems they were. And I can't say who was writing it, but I know one analogy I was reading was that a lot of political activists, you could imagine political, you know, with the infection analogy, the political activists are the white blood cells of society. And when they had nothing real to come after, they turn on themselves. They turn on society itself. And I think it was an element of that in the past couple of decades, where it was all these kind of non-problems, kind of manufactured problems that were actually hurting our society and discourse. And a lot of that, you know, I mean, that's probably one of the things I secretly am enjoying about recent events, where it's just pricked so much, you know, so much of the, what's the word, you know, essentially the bollocks, really, so much of the
Extinction Rebellion and Greta Inc. They're out of business overnight. In fact, our Premier in Victoria, Daniel Andrews, during the first week of the pandemic, announced that he was lifting the moratorium on onshore gas exploration, despite him having that renewable energy target.
Shows that people do not actually hold these views with great conviction when other things are at risk, more real things are at risk. So it shows that so much of these belief systems were about virtue signaling. It was more about communicating identity and status within certain social groups. And, that comes tumbling down very quickly when there's more serious matters at hand and genuine threats. And even a lot of the same people who held those views, now they're scrambling to survive economically. And, suddenly the room for them to sprout those views is much more limited.
And as I said previously, we are seeing more of a nationalistic spirit during this pandemic, and it's not being viewed as a bad thing, as a lot of people thought in the past. But after this pandemic is over, because on the current projections and trends, Western Europe, the United States are going to be completely decimated in terms of both the deaths and the economic damage. And because it looks like we are going to come out of this well and better, than there's still going to be a recovery phase, but it's going to be Australia alone. We can't rely on those allies that we once had to sort of trade in that, and we're certainly not going to trust China like we have in the past, or basically being compliant with them as a lot of our politicians and businesses were.
Look, we don't know yet. So that would be the hope. Now, certainly the hope is that we do get through this better than others, and there is the chance. And I think you are right. There'll be a lot of changes to this. I mean, one, there'll be much more focus on self-sufficiency, especially in matters of national security. So there'll be a sense that we need to have a manufacturing base, that we need to have some key thing, medicines, et cetera. We need to have some key things. So I think there will be reversion to sorts, a bit more of an internal reversion. So in some ways we are all reverting, be it to family and nation. We're kind of, reaching inwards a bit. And most of that is quite positive. But we do still need global institutions. I remember something I was just reading this morning. I think it was former Swedish Prime Minister tweeted, suddenly the G20, the United Nations, they all look pretty weak. Mm. And one of the few, and the US looks very weak as a global power here, and the only global force, is COVID. That's the only superpower at the moment.
Well, World Health Organization, their credibility and has been decimated as well.
They've lost a lot of credibility over this, and this is another area where Australia was ahead of the curve. We banned flights from China against World Health Organization recommendations, and that was a very good decision. So this is where, again, our institutions and authorities have acted very well on many of the questions through this crisis. So look, a hell of a lot's going to change. This is a world historical event, Tim. Where we're all going to come out the other side slightly changed. Some things will reemerge, but these are transformative, and we're all going to adapt. I think that's what we're going to focus on. But I think Australia will, certainly at this stage, the way it's looking, we have the potential to come out much stronger than many countries in the Western world.
Well, our leaders are sticking to that 6-month time frame where these containment measures have got to be in place. And we are slowly getting used to it despite the shock. And obviously, I mentioned the stay-at-home advice, the four reasons that you're only allowed to leave the house. One of them is exercising, because, well, it has been an expression like, I need to get out of the house to basically clear my head, get some fresh air. That's a legitimate form, because there are health effects to being cooped up. And of course, some people are, as you said, coping better than others. Some people already kept to themselves and stayed at home most of the time, didn't go out. Others, their whole lives was social events and going to gigs and sporting events. And obviously, they've been affected as well. Our arts and sports, live entertainment, that's all been shut down.
Yeah, look, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry, I missed the actual question there, Tim.
Oh, I was saying that the way that we've been in terms of the social gatherings, I'll rephrase it there, with attendance at arts, sports, live entertainment, events, basically that's how the lifestyle was going out, not on the town, seeing the city. That's obviously, we've been told 6 months, but obviously there's going to be still massive changes in how we consume those things and how those businesses survive.
Look, yeah, a lot of that's going to change, isn't it? You're right. I mean, some things won't go back. And a lot of that will be better. I mean, even in my industry and certainly the law and so a lot of areas where they've been just very slow to embrace that digital side when they're forced to do it now. And I've been dealing with some lawyers when I do criminal work, and many of them have said, you know, look, some we should have been doing this years ago. We just haven't had to. So many of the things, epidemics historically, and something, my next column in the Financial Review is about this, is that epidemics speed up history. So a host of other trends. So when you look at past trends, for example, in the Spanish flu, trends like apartheid, for example, it changed the way blacks and whites were interacting. And even though there were ideas around apartheid, it actually got sped up by the Spanish flu. Likewise, the bubonic plague, the certainly view that was a key factor in the Industrial Revolution, because it made labor much more expensive because there was a much less supply of it. And this was much more pronounced in Northern Europe and particularly places like the United Kingdom. And that was a key driver because capital was so expensive in compared to labor. There was a much stronger incentives for the developments that led to the Industrial Revolution. So we're seeing that too now. Especially, say, digital, you look at companies like Amazon, et cetera, who are really profiting from this digital bank. So the shift to digital will be heightened. But I also think there was also a wider protest here in recent years, say Brexit, Trump. Part of that was a half century of social and economic liberalism, which placed individualism, individual autonomy, individual desire, all of these kind of things at the top, at the expense of, say, family, community, tradition, country, all of these kind of things. And Brexit, Trump, to some extent, were a protest against that. And coronavirus is accelerating those trends. It's accelerated those trends, you know, in a very big way. So suddenly we're all anti-globalists and we're breeding into family, community, tradition in an extraordinary way.
Yeah, that's exactly what I've concluded as well. As we've both said, it looks like Australia will come out of this better in terms of containing it and having less deaths and having a faster economic recovery. But we always put an asterisk against our predictions during this pandemic because it's a virus. It's not a human being. We don't know how it's going to react. But I've appreciated you coming on, Tanvir, to share your expertise and analysis, and all the best with your continued practice. And obviously, I will keep looking out for you in the Financial Review and on Sky News in My View and other appearances.
Excellent. Good luck to you, Tim, and stay safe.
This is Will's Front, brought to you by theunshackled.net.
And that concludes the interview there. I'm back live now. I enjoyed interacting with my live audience in the chat while I was playing that. I've been putting the entropy link in the live chat, so you can, now that we're back to live, you can send me a question or send through a super chat. To conclude the show today, I'm going to go through, as I do during every Wilms Front episode at the moment, go through the coronavirus infection and death figures. And as I introduced on Monday night's show, the Australian Department of Health, now they've now released a more detailed infographics on the infection, death rates, the breakdowns of where the infections are coming from, and also how we're doing with our goal of flattening the curve. So I downloaded today's infographic. This was published at 3 p.m. Melbourne time on the Department of Health's website on today, which is the 8th of April 2020. So this is at 3 p.m. As of 3 p.m., as at the time of broadcast, we are now over 6,000 cases. This is how the current status is by the day: 5,908 cases, 45 deaths. That has gone up to 50 now, and 2,547 cases recovered, which is, that's quite an incredible amount of recoveries. Current cases in the intensive care units, 93. Current cases admitted to hospital, 305. So as you can see, ICU hospital admissions are incredibly low in Australia. We've carried out 310,000 tests with a 1.9% positive actually, I'm just, says this was published yesterday, so just scrap that because I'll bring up there the most up-to-date figures here, or let me say refresh there. I'll just go by the updated Department of Health website, scrap that, even though it says that this was today. Anyway, on with the show. So these are the up-to-date figures. So total cases as of... This is still up-to-date information. Ah, forget it. Government is so slow. Let's forget it. All right, let's just have a look at the global tally board. Why don't we do with that? That's my mistake for having faith with the government statistics. So we're going to go over to Worldometers now. This will give us updated information here. All right, so we'll go down to Australia here. So we're at 6,010 cases, 50 deaths, 2,547 recovered. If we go back up the top there, USA now has over 400,000 cases. They had their deadliest day with over 1,000 deaths. And this information here is not quite accurate. See that they're up to 12,857 total deaths there. Spain is on 14,555, second most amount of cases in the world. Italy still leading the global death toll. France has just clocked up 10,000 deaths, 109,000 cases. Italy, as I said, is third in terms of total cases. This graph goes by the total amount of cases. China still claims, well, they have 3,333 deaths, only two new deaths and 81,000 infections. We all know that's BS. And Iran's death rate has gone up significantly. That's now at 4,000 total deaths, 67,286 cases. We might as well check on Israel because we had our guests there Monday night. Israel's infection total cases has gone up to 9,404, and they've got 71 deaths. And of course, with the UK cases, one of those 55,000 cases is British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, he disclosed it was not last Friday, Friday before, he'd been diagnosed with coronavirus. He was self-isolating. He had mild symptoms, but he's now in intensive care because his breathing deteriorated. We're told that he's not on a ventilator, that he doesn't have pneumonia, but it's really quite shaken the nation and also the world, the fact that a major world leader is in intensive care because of this virus. And there's talk about who is leading the country now, and it's likely to go, well, the caretaker prime minister is likely to be the Chancellor Dominic Raab, who is seen as competent, but he's quite inexperienced as well in terms of, well, stepping up to be prime minister. I mean, just look at the year that Boris Johnson had before when he took the took over from Theresa May. He had to go to he had to drag the nation to a general election to resolve the Brexit question, and the UK public overwhelmingly gave him a mandate for the UK to finally leave the European Union at the end of January 2020, Brexit Day. It's finally happened, and now they're negotiating they've got a 1-year negotiation period with the EU on what their future trading will be. But, well, in terms of the EU is one of the big losers of the year, because all the countries in the Schengen area have closed their borders. The EU free movement doesn't exist at the moment because that's what lockdown is. All the national borders are shut there. And, well, the United Nations, the European Union has been one of the globalist casualties, as has the United Nations. But the biggest globalist organization to have, as I said in the interview, its credibility decimated is the World Health Organization. And it was refreshing today. Donald Trump said at a press conference that his administration was looking at suspending US aid to the World Health Organization, because you have to remember that these globalist bodies, the only way they can exist is with the taxpayer funds of sovereign nations. And of course, all the White House press corps was like, how could you strip it from funding during a pandemic? But what's it actually doing, the World Health Organization, during this pandemic? It's basically every nation for itself in terms of getting essential medical supplies, the ICU beds. The World Health Organization is not facilitating anything. Remember, they didn't declare a pandemic until it was on every Western nation's doorstep. They praised China for containing the virus. They said that a travel ban from China was not necessary, and stigmatizing those who had coronavirus was actually worse than the disease itself. It has totally been in the pocket of China throughout all this time, and it again raises the question of why do governments, especially when there's conservative, supposedly anti-globalists in charge, why do they continue to fund these bodies and take lectures from them? And of course, these are the same governments that continue to, in Australia, fund organisations such as the ABC and have all those arts and university grants as well. As we're repeatedly being told, and I'll just bring up the... because the curve on the Department of Health website is, on the whole, accurate. So I'll just bring it up here. So as you can see there, the curve is significantly not just flattening, but it's dipping significantly there. We're near under 100 cases per day. And overseas acquired is the majority source of infections, though locally acquired in the turquoise contact of a confirmed case, that's in turquoise there, and in light blue, that's the contact not identified, and then the grey is under investigation. And this is it shows that Australian confirmed cases overseas by region. You can see that Europe, cruise ships, the Americas, and look, if you're looking in Northeast Asia, Southeast Asia, hardly any of that wagon wheel on the screen here. You'd say less than 10% of Australian cases were from the region where the outbreak was, which I think overwhelmingly shows that it was a globalist disease. Port Film Co-op has got a question. Why does that Australian flag in the background look so crisp that it's never been waved? I just keep it in good condition. That's the secret there. It is a high quality flag. It's from Carroll and Richardson. It's not some cheap one you get at the $2 shop. It's a high quality woven Australian flag. So there you go. I'm just going to put the Entropy link in again. So if you want to ask a question or send through a super chat, you can. Our federal parliament sat again today, albeit in a slimmed down, socially distanced parliament, because they need to sit past the federal government's $130 billion JobKeeper program, which is to make sure that those who have been stood down during this time, they have a payment, and when this pandemic is over, they can go back to work when their business that they're working for is allowed to reopen. But that is the big question now. When are some of these severe draconian containment and restriction measures going to be lifted, given that we talked about on the Uncuckables last night, Victoria Police and New South Wales Police issuing fines to learner drivers, people playing backyard cricket, and also questioning those at shopping centres to say, what's your business being here? So it is getting quite invasive that you basically have to give a reason now if a policeman pulls you over while you're at. In normal times, we just say, none of your business, because we have freedom of movement, but we're not living in this time as well. We've been told to be vigilant during Easter because that's when the infections spike. So we're being told not to holiday. If you've got a holiday home, don't go to it. Just stay at home, have a quiet Easter. Another development from the federal parliament sitting today is there will be a new Senate Select Committee to scrutinise the government measures during the pandemic, which is we need scrutiny from the legislature on the executive during this time, and that should not just be at the state level. Oh, sorry, the federal level. It should also be at the state level as well. I think there should be one in every state parliament, Victoria, New South Wales, Queensland, because it's the state governments and police forces that are enforcing these draconian containment measures. So I certainly think it's something that all our parliaments need. Of course, the biggest non-coronavirus news of the past 2 days has been the High Court of Australia quashing Catholic Cardinal George Powell's conviction for historical child sex crimes. It was a 7-0 decision by the full bench of the High Court, and basically slapped down the entire Victorian legal system, from the police to the Director of Public Prosecution, and of course rebuked the Victorian Court of Appeal, which decided 2-1 to uphold the conviction. And it is, if you read the High Court judgment, it's because I know that all the lefties on Twitter, and particularly Clementine Ford, they said respect the legal process when they were getting the decisions that they liked from the County Court of Victoria and the Victorian Court of Appeal, but because the High Court overturned this and scolded the Victorian legal sister that basically said justice is dead in Australia, and they're still calling George Pell a pedophile, even though his convictions have been quashed. Not guilty means he's innocent. Remember how our legal system works? Innocent until proven guilty. That's how it works. George Pell has no criminal record now. And so you may, obviously, they've always hated George Pell and see him as a representation of everything that's wrong with the Catholic Church. And there's long been accusations that he's been complicit in the church moving around pedophile priests and accusations that the Catholic Church in Australia's response to child sexual abuse was not adequate. But he wasn't on trial for that. He was on trial for that specific supposed offence in St. Patrick's Cathedral in Melbourne in 1996. And I noticed today that despite we're supposedly in lockdown, vandalism was still able to take place outside the cathedral, still calling him a pedophile and all of those names, which is, it's one thing to write that those smears on social media, but to vandalize an actual church and break self-isolation, that is quite, I would say, way beyond the pale. And there is talk now whether there needs to be some form of, whether it be a Royal Commission investigation probe into Victoria Police, the director of, and the Director of Public Prosecutions' decision to prosecute George Pell, even though it was clear to most legal minds that you couldn't have convicted Pell based on the sole testimony of the surviving witness beyond all reasonable doubt, even despite the fact that there are also the 23 opportunity witnesses who said, look, the way that these services were conducted Sunday Mass, there's no way that he could have been at two places at once, because that day he was outside greeting parishioners at the time that the supposed sex acts were supposed to take place. And you have to remember that the Victoria Police has also been rocked by the Lawyer X scandal, Nicola Gobbo. There's a Royal Commission into that, how she was a gangland lawyer yet ratting on her clients, which is a big no-no in our legal system. So it hasn't been a good couple of years for the legal system in Victoria. And George Pell now, after he was released from Barwon Prison which is near Geelong, he is now on his way to Sydney. And some people might be asking, how can he cross state lines during the lockdown? There is still no border control between Victoria and New South Wales. There is with all the other states, but not between Victoria and New South Wales, which is, given that they're the two states are with the highest amount of cases and deaths, it's amazing that they haven't shut the border on each other. But the snapperazzi, they've been out stalking George Pell, trying to get footage of him. It's sort of reminds me of when Chappelle Corby was released from prison. And this is, somebody sent this to the media. They snapped him at a petrol station here. So you can see him here. He's just getting a newspaper. There, this is basically, it's in the Pell Watch or Pell Cam. You can see he's just queuing up there. But it's sort of a sight you don't see any day. A Catholic cardinal, the third most powerful person at the Vatican in Rome, the treasurer there, he's just at the local servo on the way on a road trip to Sydney, just there. And I know he's been through quite an ordeal, 404 days falsely in prison, but he still looks all right there. He is 78 years old and got a heart condition. I think definitely now he's probably going to, as they say, hang up the frock. And you would say to the mainstream media and also to the vitriol is just leave him alone now. I mean, you got him. I mean, he was locked up for a year. To all those leftists who just want to see him suffer. I mean, you know, you got some sort of some satisfaction out of seeing him in jail for a year, albeit falsely. They still believe that he should be locked up forever. They still think that he committed those crimes, but they still like to see him locked up anyway for his crimes against the Catholic Church. And if one of the most objective voices throughout this whole Pell saga was Father Frank Brennan. Yes, he is also a Catholic priest, but he is in no way a church ideological ally of Pell. Father Frank Brennan is a Jesuit priest. And for those of you familiar with Jesuits in Catholicism, it's basically the SJW faction of the Catholic Church. Frank Brennan has been, obviously he doesn't go against the teaching of the church, but in terms of, he's also a practicing lawyer as well. He's been in favor of very liberal social policy, whereas Pell has been a staunch conservative, both in the church and in the Australian culture wars at large. And he basically said more eloquently than I have said that the whole process was flawed from the start, that Victoria Police basically went looking for complainants against Pell. And the complainant, he has put out a statement saying he accepts the High Court's decision. He'll be making no further comment. Most people in the media who have been Pell's defenders do believe that he was raped by a priest, but it was a case of mistaken identity, given that it was so many years ago, and given the fact that it was just implausible. During that Sunday Mass at St. Paul's Cathedral. So we hope that this is, well, Twitter always moves on to the next outrage. They've been giving it a pretty good go by their repeated smearing of Pell the last 48 hours. Like I said, there'll be something else that they'll be outraged about soon. And you should read the two Unshackled articles on the Pell verdict by Philippe Armstrong, first on the ABC, because they basically led the media witch hunt against Pell. They were airing that ABC Revelation series hosted by Sarah Ferguson at the time the High Court appeal process was happening, which trolled over again the Catholic Church sexual abuse scandal. And today's article went after Clementine Ford for her abusive tweets. And of course, I know that I've said previously that I think Clementine Ford, she's coming around. She's going away from her toxic feminism, caring for her son, and also with her husband as well. But I guess I spoke too soon. She was back to her vitriolic worst yesterday. And I know that I talked about during the interview with Tanvir about Mike Carlton saying that we all need to get behind Australia and the Prime Minister during this time. I spoke too soon. Polite Mike lasted barely a week, and he was back to being his angry old lefty ex-radio shock jock on Twitter, yelling some abuse at Gideon Rosner from the Institute of Public Affairs, saying that we need an exit strategy from this lockdown, given that there's been so much economic destruction for it. And Mike Carlton drops the F-bomb frequently on Twitter, and that was no exception there. So yes, maybe I give these toxic leftists such as Clementine Ford and Mike Carlton too much of the benefit of the doubt. It's your last chance to ask a question or send through a super chat on Entropy. Entropy will be back for all future Wilmsfront episodes now that I've got it working. I had to move the Tim Wilms channel to a brand account, so we're now the Wilmsfront channel, so that I can access programs such as Entropy. Obviously, this is the final show for the week, but of course, Wilmsfront will be back 7 p.m. Melbourne time next Monday and Wednesday on the Wilmsfront YouTube channel, and it will also be back on DLive very soon. Of course, there's always the podcast version as well, and you can access that as well as my social media links at timwilms.com. And of course, the Wilmsfront archive, it's nearly all up to date on rationalrise.tv. And at the moment, I am just updating the Unkuggables archive as well as the Trad Tasman Talk archive as well. And I'm also building a dedicated website for the Retort from Tiger Mountain, which with Richard Wollstonecroft as well. So I'm getting a lot done at the moment, which is, it's always pleasing when you can be quite productive. And of course, well, the Unshackled, we can run it from anywhere. So as I said, the move back home has been quite a good one for me, and as I previously said, I get used to it, but we'll see how the end of this pandemic plays out. Now, don't go anywhere now, because DPL Tran Live is on at 8:30 p.m. Melbourne time. She's got as her guest the editor of Culture Wars magazine, E. Michael Jones, who has basically been the spiritual intellectual leader of the groper army, the Zoomers, who embarrassed Charlie Kirk at Turning Point USA speaking events, their fake Culture Wars tour, exposing them on three grounds, which is dual loyalty, mass immigration, and cultural degeneracy. E. Michael Jones, he's spent his entire, most of his entire intellectual life being unknown to most people. He's now in his 70s, and he's just seeing the fruits of his hard labor throughout his lifetime now coming to fruition. Now everyone wants to talk to him, and of course, well, he's been working, he's been a thinker and intellectual philosopher for his whole life, and so he's eager to spread his ideas to the world now. I might have him on a Wilmsfront episode in the future. I haven't decided, but we shall see his appearance with Dia shortly. And of course, tomorrow night will be regular Thursday edition of The Uncuckables, 8:30 p.m. Melbourne time on the show YouTube channel. It'll be myself, David Hiscock, and either James Fox Higgins or Maddie Rose. And then, of course, to finish out the week, Trad Tasman Talk with the editor of Right Minds, Zoe DeBoer, 6 p.m. Melbourne time on the Unshackled YouTube channel. And I think I almost forgot, after Dia tonight, there's another episode of The Patriarch Hour with James and Noah on the Rational Rise James Fox Higgins YouTube channel. So plenty still on at the moment in terms of, well, as I said, we're a internet broadcast operation, so we can bring you the news directly from wherever we are. So it's been a great time. We've certainly enjoyed keeping you informed, breaking down what is some of the misinformation and also the scaremongering, and bringing you the most accurate and important information you need to know. All right, that's it from me tonight. I'll see you all tomorrow night. Wilmsfront will be back next week. Until then...
Thanks for tuning in to Wilmsfront. Visit timwilms.com or Rationalrise TV to view the archive of episodes. And keep visiting theunshackled.net to view all our shows. And to keep up with the latest real news and analysis. Thanks for tuning in to Wilmsfront. Visit timwilms.com or Rational Rise TV to view the archive of episodes. And keep visiting theunshackled.net to view all our shows. And to keep up with the latest real news and analysis.